4. A shot in the park. The gangland war erupts. 1999 to 2010. The park where the gangland war began is squeezed between houses in the suburb of Gladstone Park, like a planning afterthought. There are no signs, no tour groups. Here, drug baron Jason Moran did not kill wannabe drug baron Carl Williams on the 13th of October 1999. Instead, he wanted to remind Williams, in his mambo shirt and thongs, of his place. There was history between them. Jason Moran and Williams had recently scuffled after a friend of Williams had failed to return a piano belonging to Moran. Williams had also taken up with Roberta, the wife of Moran associate Dean Stevens. To this day, Roberta Williams says Carl saved her from Stevens. But that's not why they were in the park. They were there because Jason and his half-brother Mark were upset about a delivery of pills from Williams that had crumbled, a disputed pill press, and Williams's undercutting of the Moran price of ecstasy tablets. They wanted $400,000, whereas Williams believed Mark Moran owed him $1 million. Dead men cannot pay. So Jason whipped out a .22-caliber Derringer and shot Williams in the stomach instead of the head. "We want that bullet back, you fucking dog," one of the Moran brothers reportedly said. The aftermath of the Williams-Moran encounter heightened its oddness. The three men drove, in the same car, back to where they had met earlier at a nearby shopping centre. A wounded Williams had turned 29 that day, and came home to find his mother, Barbara, had baked a chocolate birthday cake. He reluctantly went to hospital 5 hours later, where he invoked the criminal's code of silence and told police he'd been knocked out while on a walk and had woken up with a pain in his stomach. He couldn't remember a thing, he said. Yet Jason Moran had made a fatal mistake by not listening to brother Mark, who had urged him to kill Williams. After this encounter in a park with no name, a grudge would morph into a vendetta and launch an unprecedented bloodbath. Moran had underestimated Williams. He'd inadvertently started a gangland war in which 30 or more people would be killed, while countless police officers built careers on responding to the community's increasing demands for action. Gangland lacked the codes of Italian mob warfare. Gangland was all about Victoria's rocketing recreational drugs market. Over the previous decade, ecstasy, MDMA, and speed, methamphetamine, had begun flooding the Melbourne party scene. Everywhere you turned, otherwise law-abiding citizens were throwing down pills for a fun night out. Most young adults of the era seemed to try ecstasy at least once, though Dowsley claims that he did not. By 1990, Melbourne was known as the amphetamine capital of Australia. Levi Diamond's client, John Higgs, was behind much of the importation and production during this time. Higgs was thought to have got his start from Hell's Angel bikie Peter Hill, who learned how to make speed on a trip to America and sold the recipe to him for $1,000. Hill was eventually convicted of drug crimes. The genesis of the underworld conflict is often traced to the 1996 arrest of Higgs, considered the dominant player in drug trafficking since the previous decade. An informer file linked to Higgs and his syndicate was stolen from the Victoria Police Drug Squad in early 1997, leading to questions about corrupt cops and the force's ability to protect high-risk sources. Higgs's subsequent downfall is said to have created a vacuum of power in the underworld swamp. Williams believed there was enough demand for ecstasy and speed for all the main drug traffickers to get rich. They could have shared drug cooks and cooperated on importations while avoiding petty grudges. Williams's Pollyanna thinking had been sound, at least in theory, but the newbie had underestimated the greed and ambition of Melbourne's more practiced drug warlords. The generals staked out their territories and nominated their enemies, but their soldiers sometimes changed sides. Gangland was sparked in October 1999, but a brutal drug trade had flourished for generations. Hidden in plain sight from Victoria Police, blood had long splattered the Melbourne wharves and produce markets in explosions of anger and brutal power plays. Yet no one ever saw a thing. Police's inability to crack the underworld's code of silence dated back to 1958, when Freddie the Frog Harrison was killed on the docks, and 30-odd witnesses, including a bystander splashed in Harrison's blood, could not identify the killer. Many of the men said they were in the toilet at the time of the murder, a two-man toilet, mind. Gangland was just an amplification of a previously unseen battlefield. Vaulting egos collided with expedience. Killing your opponent grew to be the easy option. History favoured the killers. Hampered by the criminals' refusal to assist, police almost never solved underworld murders. In any rundown of Gangland's major players, it's best to start with the Moran family. Mark Moran trailblazed the designer pill industry in the 1990s, and the Morans controlled much of Melbourne's drug trade during that decade before the upstart competitors emerged. He, along with half-brother Jason and Jason's father Lewis, were underworld royalty, their pedigree tracing to the Melbourne docks, and Lewis's membership of the Painters and Dockers Union in the 1960s. The Painters and Dockers Union controlled the Melbourne waterfront for generations after World War II. Major drug rackets, as well as prostitution and extortion cartels, were birthed over coffees in Port Melbourne cafes. Under the umbrella of union strength, power brokers decided what drugs could get through the port, a lucrative sideline that enabled dock workers to drive flash cars, and always aroused internal tensions. "We catch and kill our own," Union Secretary Jack Puttynose Nichols once said. The Morans inherited the Painters and Dockers' stranglehold on drugs in Melbourne, especially speed. Brothers Brian and Les Kane, both underworld docks enforcers, were murdered a full 2 decades before the Gangland War erupted. Les Kane's daughter Trish hooked up with a private schoolboy when he was 15, and they later married. That schoolboy was Jason Moran. Jason Moran was a thug who carried a gun before he learned to drive. Moran fired so many bullets into other people's legs that a medical condition was coined the Moran limp. In death in 2003, he was described as a gentleman, tragically taken from us. The Morans were loosely associated with Victor Pierce and Graham Kinneborough. Kinneborough called himself a retired dock worker, though his safe-cracking nous better explains his affluent address and kids' expensive schooling. Both Kinneborough and Pierce were shot dead during the Gangland War. The Mockbells were sometimes called the village people because of their lack of education and origins in rural Lebanon. Like the matriarchs of many traditional migrant families, their mother, Laura, spoke little English. She was a woman of faith and would regularly genuflect to the mounted crucifixes in her home. Laura Mockbell thought her boys were wonderful. I promise Tony is a very good boy," she would tell Dowsley in 2012. But Tony was a very naughty boy. All her sons were. 3 Mockbell brothers ran separate drug operations in loose concert. They chased, delivered, and manufactured, a hallmark of their operations being the exchange of drugs wrapped as presents. The low-key Grove Cafe in Brunswick was their preferred haunt. Each brother had a nickname. Third son Tony's was L, or Lord Mayor. Fat Tony, as he came to be known, had arrived with his parents from Lebanon via Kuwait in 1974, aged 8, and would trail his mother to her meat factory job at 4:30 a.m. each day. He couldn't speak English at first, and later said he compensated by being the class clown. He remained a slow reader and writer, but it didn't matter much. Everyone grasped the language of fear. His father died on his 15th birthday. He later said that that was when he became dirty on the world. He stopped going to school after his father's fatal heart attack. The obvious theory behind why Tony and his brothers, Milad, Horty, and Cabalan, eventually turned to a life of crime is that they lacked authority and did as they pleased. As a teenager, Tony gambled, a characteristic that would stamp his criminal grandness. He found success with a suburban pizza business, but gambling debts were said to inspire his criminal career. He was shrewd, at least in business, and acquired interests in fashion, property development, and horse racing. His on-track visits with his entourage earned them the label of the Tracksuit Gang. Mokbel coveted a veneer of legitimacy, yet his orthodox pursuits were funded with illicit drugs. Mokbel first flashed brightly into the police's sights in 1990 when he tried to bribe a county court judge to help a mate on drug charges. The episode suggested his naivete, a disregard for rules, and a belief that everyone could be bought. Mokbel turned to methamphetamine production until listening devices picked him up in incriminating discussions in the 1990s. He had his guilty verdict overturned in 1998 with a curious defense. Although he had agreed to produce the drugs, it could not be proven that he had sought to sell them. It became clear that Mokbel was making tens of millions of dollars from drug imports and production. He was raided and charged in August 2001, but it was years before the charges were heard in court and he was pronounced guilty. Milad Mokbel was the sausage-fingered younger brother who idolized Tony. He was methodical and clever, said one observer. According to another, he was overbearing and cheap. Tony had tried to dissuade Milad from trafficking heavier drugs, such as speed, so Milad attempted to keep his forays secret. Milad was trafficking drugs from at least 2002 and was later convicted. Second eldest brother, Horty Mokbel, was trafficking speed earlier than Milad, as was eldest brother Cabalan, who was convicted of delivering heavy-duty drugs connected with a methamphetamine laboratory discovered by police in 2001 in Rye on the Mornington Peninsula. Some of the Mokbels, as well as Carl Williams and another drug trafficker, Nick Radev, were suspected of investing in this laboratory. Such unlikely cooperation between sniping gangland groupings shows that, as Williams had hoped, the lure of money could at times overcome historical tensions. The episode also underscored the absurd profits of illicit drug production and trafficking. The Rye setup was one of many pop-up labs of the era producing ecstasy and speed. Drug production was a risky business, and not only because of the law. Precursor chemicals costing hundreds of thousands of dollars could be turned into drugs worth tens of millions of dollars. Such illicit alchemy required expertise, lest the investment get destroyed by poor cooking techniques. Ecstasy pills were carefully measured for quality by the market. Pills stamped with the Mitsubishi logo, for example, were known to be reliably effective pingers by their upwardly mobile constituency. The young and educated law abiders rarely dwelled on the grotty origins of their happy pills, though some of them heard that Mokbel's pills were high grade. Mokbel commandeered the best drug cooks. They were coveted by the drug lords when they were not being threatened by them and could earn up to $80,000 a week. Tony didn't inflict violence as casually as ordering hamburgers like some gangland figures. Rather, he used money to win people over to his point of view. His random generosity generated a tribe of sycophants, yet he cared little for the passing parade. They were hookers and hangers-on, there to be used until they lost their usefulness. Tony's crazy-assed audacity made people laugh. He drove a Ferrari with "Are You Dare?" number plates. He was incorrigible, inveterate, and ripe for parody. Jail stretches to him were like droughts to farmers, an unfortunate but accepted part of life. He spoke of the need to die with pride when he was arrested in 2007. Or, as his role model, TV character Tony Soprano once said, "I find I have to be the sad clown, laughing on the outside, crying on the inside." "We were all mates," Tony told an Australian reporter in 2007 in describing Gangland. "It started over a silly thing, and suddenly there were just bodies falling all around me." Mick Gatto headed the Carlton crew. He was a kind of third general who would stay standing after Carl Williams and Tony Mockbell toppled. Fond of cigars, Gatto bore the physical foreboding of a former professional heavyweight boxer, fine clothes hanging from a bear's frame. He avoided the darkly comical mayhem that surrounded Williams and Mockbell and garnered them constant media headlines. Other members of the Carlton crew attracted headlines, though. Gatto's predecessor at the top of the hierarchy, Alphonse Gangitano, had been a standover man who needed violence the way the rest of us need air. He had a penchant for literature and listed his occupation as gentleman on his will. He used to hang out with Jason Moran. That was, until Moran allegedly killed Gangitano in early 1998, for reasons that remain unclear. Gangitano died in his underpants in his laundry. This was how it went in Melbourne's underworld. Tribal disputes over drugs or debts or perceived slights ended in dead bodies, and the tossing of a gun off the Westgate Bridge. Gangitano's 1998 death was an unofficial entree for a gangland spree of caricatured notoriety. Gangitano now resides under statues of Jesus and Mary, his headstone so large that it completely overshadows his slab of gravesite marble. Ostentatious resting places became another gangland quirk. His successor, professional mediator Gatto, had other worries. Tony Mockbell had been beaten up by bikies in a meeting arranged by Gatto in 2002. Mockbell was supposed to apologise for calling the coffin cheaters' bikies dogs, but he ended up being gang-kicked as he lay on the ground. Shamed by the bruising, he hid from public view for a time and wore sunglasses for weeks. Mockbell blamed Gatto's crew for the beating, in what grew to be a significant gangland grudge. The enmity between Mockbell and Gatto was also stirred by Mockbell's flourishing friendship with Carl Williams, which began around the same time. They were allied by overlapping business pursuits, and Williams would write letters to the Mockbells until his death. Williams, who produced Speed and also bought it from Mockbell, detested Gatto. Williams undercut the market, but his alliance with Mockbell stayed productive. Mockbell had his own thoughts about how gangland might finally end. "It won't be over until that fat cunt is dead," he said of Gatto in 2004. Yet Gatto would be the only major figure to survive the war and thrive. The tinderbox of gangland was an unlikely exemplar of multiculturalism. Lebanese mixed with Russians and the Mafia, as well as Turks and skip upstarts such as Carl Williams and his father George. Crews morphed according to politics and power. The Sunshine Crew, for instance, came to be hitched to the Williamses, yet its leader, Andrew Benji Venuman, who'd almost certainly killed his predecessor, Paul Kallipolitis, was long linked to Gatto, who would kill him in 2004. Most of the Sunshine Crew members had been childhood friends. The crew also later included gangland heavyweight Rocco Orrico. Venuman, a former kickboxer with a pit bull temper, probably killed six people for money, yet he wore the flashy sunglasses and other accessories of someone who wanted to be noticed. He was mindful of the public fascination for gangland, as were Gatto and Judith Moran, the mother of Jason and Mark. They were among the underworld figures to later publish their thoughts in books. Gatto would even sign autographs in the street. "I find it an increasingly strange place where people like Mick Gatto can become social commentators," Victoria Police Assistant Commissioner Simon Overland said. "These are not nice people. They are not celebrities. They should not be treated like celebrities. The gangland war escalated quickly after Williams's stomach wound. This family feud lacked the pathos of Capulet versus Montague, but Williams versus Moran was just as murderous. Jason Moran's choice had granted Williams another decade of life, ample time for Williams to kill him, his brother Mark, his father Lewis, and up to seven others whose continuing existence was bad for Williams's business. At the time of his shooting in 1999, Carl was an ambitious bogan of 29 going on 15. He still lived with his mum Barbara and dad George. Older brother Shane, known as Pear, had died of a heroin overdose 2 years earlier. In tribute, Carl Williams vowed never to traffic heroin. Father and son bonded after Pear's death, and together they graduated into a gangland crime outfit. George was later said to pull the strings of the operation. He had grown up as a pool shark and had been blinded in one eye in a pub fight. He had moved his family to Broadmeadows, a kind of struggle street of unemployment where many of Carl's schoolmates later joined him in jail. The Williamses were close-knit, even though George and Barbara had drifted as a couple. After she moved out of the family home in Broadmeadows, her sister moved in as George's new romantic partner. When Barbara died in 2008 of a drug overdose, her son described her as his pillar of strength, whom he called on the phone each morning. Carl was considered soft as a kid, but he followed his brother into drug trafficking after leaving Broadmeadows West Technical College in year 11. He had hoped to be a policeman, until he was clocked over the head with a telephone book in a police station. When he fell in with the Morans, Carl delivered drugs and did dog's body duties. Carl was friends with his bosses. He went to the races with them on days out. He was busted in a speed lab in his 20s and served a brief stretch in jail. His drive to drug trafficking was largely driven by his aversion to hard work. He lived on fast food and hair product. Police knew little about Williams when Jason Moran shot him in the stomach in 1999. They belatedly realized that his shit-kicker status was misplaced. Williams was wily and manipulative. In just a few years, he had nurtured his own enterprises and loomed as a serious player in the Melbourne drug trade. He showed little respect for police, a common trait throughout gangland. The law was a nuisance, not a handbrake. So Williams started killing people. Psychos for hire aren't usually known for their insights, yet an armed robber and hitman who befriended Carl Williams in prison had a simple explanation for the gangland death count. Williams was a very kind person before he was shot, he said. After that, Williams's whole demeanour changed. Carl Williams's burgeoning relationship with Roberta Murchia, later Williams, fostered his desire to cleanse the playing field of old-time crooks, such as the Morans. He and Roberta married in 2001. Despite a 2000 Christmas Day incident when a pregnant Roberta confronted Carl over an affair with another woman, and he fired several shots at her, a couple of months after their daughter Dakota was born in March 2001, Carl was charged with drug offences after an undercover sting. While remanded on these charges, Carl Williams befriended Tony Mockbell in prison. Williams appeared to obey few underworld codes. He presented as a loving son, a devoted husband, and a doting dad, but also as an odd blend of apathy and violence. He looked like a teddy bear with hard eyes. His goofy expression hid a reptilian heart. He anointed himself as the premier. He drove a war that resembled a spectator sport for ghouls. The soldiers wore Gucci watches, drove expensive black cars, and mangled pronouns. They thrived, then died, in a macabre spectacle of bad blokes whacking other bad blokes. Men died for being too close or too distant, for owing money or being owed, because of lifelong feuds or passing rages. Loyalties and suspicions collided with paybacks and rip-offs in a haze of drug-induced paranoia. The victims' wives, bowing to the accepted gangland narrative, publicly called for revenge. Those close to Williams say he didn't pull the trigger on Mark Moran, killed outside his home on the 15th of June 2000. Williams took pride in not carrying a firearm. But he was the chief suspect, despite his insistence that CCTV footage from a bottle shop showed he could not have committed the hit himself. The killing was originally considered revenge for the death of fruiterer Frank Benvenuto. When Benvenuto, the local Calabrian mafia head, was gunned down in his Bayside Melbourne driveway in 2000, he was on the phone to his standover man, Victor Pierce. For years, police suspected that he had told Pierce the name of his killer. A career hitman, Rod, the Duke, Collins, was a suspect among many. Melbourne's then-busiest hitman, Benji Venuman, placed a tribute to Mark Moran in the Herald Sun. "You are a true, sincere gentleman, never to be forgotten." Venuman was said to be the shooter when Victor Pierce was shot dead in his car in Port Melbourne on the 1st of May 2002. Few people mourned Pierce's loss. He was notorious for being tried and acquitted for the killing of two police officers, Stephen Tynan and Damien Eyre, in Walsh Street, South Yarra, in 1988. When Pierce's family placed flowers at his Port Melbourne murder scene, onlookers tossed them into a nearby bin. Police explored many theories. One version said Pierce was killed because he knew who had shot Frank Benvenuto in 2000. This theory also linked Pierce's murder to the deaths of standover man Dino Dibra in 2000 and drug trafficker Paul Kalapolitis in 2002. The common link was the suspected killer, Venuman. The shootings mounted. Nick Radov, a drug manufacturer who preferred using torture to talking to get his way, wanted the services of one of Mokbel's drug cooks. When Radev stepped out of his black Mercedes in Coburg on the 15th of April 2003, he was shot 7 times. Williams was thought to have ordered the hit because Radev was bullying his way to gangland significance. Radev enjoyed one consolation. He died wearing a Versace suit and a $20,000 watch. Not bad for a man whose official work history amounted to an 8-month stint in a fish and chip shop in the 1980s. Assistant Commissioner Simon Overland once said that organised crime never ends. Likewise, the police would never tire in their pursuit of these career criminals. "The message is, you can get away with things for a period of time, but eventually we'll catch up with you," he told The Age in 2004. The longer history bears out Overland's observation. Gobbo represented Carl Williams and Tony Mokbel and Mokbel's crew. She advised Mick Gatto and Farouk Orman, the alleged getaway driver in the Pierce killing. She was also close to police officers such as Stephen Campbell and Paul Dale. She was playing all sides, the cops and the crims, and the lawyers who represented the glue between them. She knew all of the gangland players, good and bad. She chortled at their jokes, babysat their kids, and woke up next to them. And they didn't know her at all. No one did. Least of all herself.